From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainable lifestyles. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is on assignment in Bhutan this week, so joining me for co-hosting duties is Larry Warren, station manager and co-host of Mountain Money, heard here each Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks for joining me, Larry.
You bet. And I had no idea Nell was in Bhutan.
Yes.
What in the world is she? Is her assignment in Bhutan?
That we will figure that out when she gets okay. back in a few weeks. But today we've got a couple of fascinating guests. First, we'll speak with the CEO of Rocky Mountain Power and PacifiCorp, Richard Walgie. He and I sat down a couple of weeks ago and chatted about everything from nuclear power to the future of coal-fired power plants to the impact personal behavior is having on energy demands. And our Rocky Mountain Power's plans to build any additional renewable energy systems. That conversation is in the first half of the show.
And then in the second half, Chris and I will speak to Paul Sabin. He's an associate professor of American history at Yale and the author of a new book titled The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over Earth's Future. And Ehrlich, if you follow the environmental movement, you've probably heard of many times. He was the author of the book, The Population Bomb, and he predicted that rising populations would cause overconsumption, resource scarcity, and famine on a global scale, kind of Mr. Doom and Gloom.
Right.
And Simon was an economist, and he optimistically countered that growing populations would actually be good for society because they'd create collective ingenuity, flexible markets, and greater, not less, abundance, kind of the Reagan Morning in America theme.
Exactly. So in 1980, Simon challenged Ehrlich to a simple wager on the future prices of five metals as a means of testing each side's position, either coming prosperity or global doom.
So that bet ended in 1990, but the argument over it and the polarization it caused between environmentalists and the free market continues to this day. They're still at each other's throats.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to Paul Sabin all about that. It's the environment, our connections with it, and the impacts upon it. It's This Green Earth. And it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Park City Restore turns your donation of gently used home furnishings, construction materials, and furniture into affordable housing through Habitat for Humanity in Summit and Wasatch Counties. Check habitat-utah.org for a list of items accepted at the Restore during business hours, Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6. Restore is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and the concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. You know, a couple of weeks ago, like I said, I had the opportunity to speak to Richard Walgie. He's the CEO of Rocky Mountain Power and PacifiCorp. We spoke about Rocky Mountain Power's energy portfolio, their trends and plans for renewable energy systems like wind and solar. And so the following is a taped interview. It's a shortened version of our fuller conversation. So here it is, and enjoy. Richard Walgie is president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Power at PacifiCorp. He was appointed to this position in March 2006 and as such has executive management responsibility for the company's strategy, operations, customer service, and community relations in Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. Richard Walgie, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Let's turn to energy systems, and we'll start with coal. Back in 2004, approximately 68% of Rocky Mountain Power's electrical generation came from coal. Now, as of 2011, that number has decreased down to about 60%. Can you tell us why that's happened, and are there plans to bring that percentage down even further?
Primarily, that percentage has been reduced because back in about 2005, we thought we might be building new coal-fired generation. That was the time that Waxman-Markey legislation was in play in Congress. Kerry Lieberman for cap-and-trade legislation on CO2. And we started thinking more about our resources, what society was evolving to, and how people were becoming more concerned about CO2 emissions. And we concluded that we shouldn't add any more coal into our portfolio at that point in time. We were still growing very rapidly, so we had to do something. So the two things we did primarily was to build two or three new gas-fired power plants, like the two at the old Geneva plant in Utah County and one in Mona in Juab County, and also bought a gas-fired power plant in Chehalis, Washington. And we also invested in over 1,000 megawatts of wind, primarily in Wyoming and the Columbia River Gorge, because the wind's so much better there from a quality perspective. Right. So coal is going to be phasing out,
okay. And
we won't be building new coal, but it has more to do with continued growth of our load and meeting that load that's putting that percentage down.
Okay. So, and like you say, that as coal phases down, trends down, natural gas and renewables will probably be taking its place?
Correct.
Okay.
You know, right now we're in compliance with all of the environmental regulations that we're currently required to meet. But for instance, our carbon power plant, which was our oldest plant in the mouth of Price Canyon, we were not able to find a way actually that was economic or almost physically because of the location of that plant and its age. So we're shutting it down in March of 2015. We were expecting to run that until 2020, so it is coming down a little earlier than we had planned in its depreciable life, because each of our plants, for regulatory purposes, are given a life expectancy.
Right.
And so those plants, that's a plant that we're bringing to close sooner because we're not able to meet the projected environmental requirements.
And that's an interesting point. I mean, there are more restringent, or we'll call it more challenging, environmental policies or regulations that are going to be coming out. Do you see those challenges or other units, carbon-based units, facing those similar challenges?
We actually follow this very closely, as you might expect, because our coal-fired power plants are our least expensive resources. But we have to look at every single one of our units and look at how old are they, how expensive are they, what can we do to actually bring them into compliance with more stringent requirements? And then it's an economic decision, which is, well, are we better off making this investment in this plant and meeting our obligations as far as environmental compliance, or should we come up with an alternative? So we don't have a renewable portfolio standard in Utah of the more typical type that says we have to have X percentage of our energy come from this type of resource.
Right.
We have a low carbon standard in the state of Utah, which isn't as descriptive or prescriptive about what we can do
as compared to, say,
California or Oregon, where they'll say by 2025 we need to have 25%, or I think in California now it's actually 33 1/3, come from renewable energy, and that means solar, wind, biomass. So it's a kind of a specific listing of resource types that are considered renewable from that perspective. And so Utah has a target, and we're on track to meet the target. In fact, I'd hope to get that number updated for this interview, but we weren't able to get it done. We can get it to you later. But we are making progress to the percentage of energy that we deliver coming from a renewable resource.
Okay, well, let's turn to renewables then. What is Rocky Mountain Power's plans with respect to wind, geothermal, and hydroelectric? We'll just go through each one. How about wind?
Okay. One of the things we're always asked, well, why don't you just go do this, or why don't you just go do that? Well, industrial customers, environmental groups, regulators, everybody's involved in this. And frankly, everybody has a little different perspective,
Sure. Different
sets of objectives. So once that's in place, we have the obligation as much as possible to follow through that plan. Now, things change dramatically. So natural gas prices have just come down to an nominal fashion, lower than they've been in decades.
Right.
And inflation adjusted, it's even more so. So that all of a sudden makes almost every decision a default decision on natural gas for 24 hours a day
right.
Resources.
But but there is a volatility associated with natural
Correct.
Gas, too, that there's a risk associated with that because natural gas can suddenly swing up in a way that suddenly makes it more expensive than, let's say, coal.
And so that's exactly right. And sometimes that happens in between this two-year planning process, and we take steps that are not necessarily totally consistent with that process because we want to still make the right decision. That's supposed to be a guide, not here's your cookbook. You have to add three teaspoons of that and two
right.
teaspoons of that. So, but to go back to renewables, when we decided not to build these coal plants, as I said, we went and we built 1,000 megawatts of wind in Wyoming, and we also bought the output of 700 more megawatts of wind. That actually makes us the largest utility owner of wind turbines in America. So we have a pretty strong track record, I'd say, in the last few years of developing wind. We also developed the first geothermal plant outside of California as a utility, our Blundell plant back in the 80s. And so that's still in service. And now we're starting to look at how we start to bring solar into our environment. There is some component of solar in our integrated resource plan, but it's not large amounts.
Right.
And it's not driven by some other statutory requirement, say, like a renewable portfolio standard.
I don't see a lot of solar
right.
plants or solar farms under Rocky Mountain Power's portfolio.
Right.
Is that correct?
We have no company-owned solar projects in our plan today.
Okay.
And I didn't really fully answer your first question, which is where I wanted to go, which is we don't have any resources in our plan for the next 10 years of any magnitude because two or three things have happened. One of them is our customers, particularly our residential customers, are using less electricity than they have before. So this is a phenomenon that's happened 3 years in a row. That is completely out of our experience because before our load growth was being driven both by several factors, economic activity, which was very strong,
right.
Load growth driven by population growth. And also then there was a great deal of conversion along the Wasatch Front from evaporative cooling or no cooling to central air.
So more efficiencies, levels yeah. of efficiencies and conservation. Perhaps,
exactly. And more less economic activity. So we don't have any resources in our plan for the next 10 years because we don't need them with our current set of portfolio assets. So everybody says, well, why don't you do more? Well, we don't have a customer who needs incremental generation of any type.
You've got enough electrons right now, basically.
We think to last for about 10 years. For major
right.
additions. The trend in the United States is for less electricity consumption on a per capita basis across the entire country. In fact, our company is one of the few companies in the country that now has even any positive load growth. Everyone else's, their loads are falling off. And in fact, our Pacific Power sister utility, this is the first year in six that they're going to sell more electricity this year than they did the year before. So what that does is opens up more generation on the market that we can import on this transmission system we've built. So not only do we not need resources to build, we think we can rely on the market for a period of time. And mm-hmm. I think our IRP takes that out to about 10 years.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about how load growth is trending down. I am one of those people who are using less electricity through
yeah.
measures of efficiency. And you know what else I did, Richard? I shut off my hot tub.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, my electric bill went down 40% year over year by turning off my hot tub. People don't believe that we can make a difference,
yeah.
but there is. And it's showing up on your books.
Yeah. We actually... In fact, we are going to do a survey of 100,000 Utah customers to try to find out how they're actually using their electricity because this change is so dramatic, it's outside of our experience. So we need to understand, are people finally getting our messages? Because we have an award-winning program called WattSmart. And when mm-hmm. I say award-winning, the advertisements and the approach have been recognized by others in this industry as being very good. And we think that's even subliminally perhaps is starting to land with customers. Or they hear about it, and I shut my hot tub off as well and saw a vast improvement.
Yes.
Now I just need to turn my water feature off, and I think I'll be happy, get a few more LED lights in my kitchen, some of those things. But I think
small steps, Rick.
Yeah,
don't beat yourself up.
Well, but the actual thing is the aggregation of those small steps is probably, in a way, more achievable than some of the grand plans that people think we should undertake. We have more direct control over what happens in our electric future than most people recognize.
I agree with you. I've said before that, you know, everyone looks for an energy policy out of Washington, and we need one. But you know what else we need? We need 300 million energy policies, you know, one for each home and business. And that's how people have to think. And that can make as big, if not more, of a difference.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, one of the things we're just rolling out is a new set of business energy efficiency programs called Watt Smart Business. And one of the things that's happened with information technology, it's easier to gather information about the state of electrical equipment within a manufacturing or commercial facility where they can manage their peak demand, which is another component of what we have to manage, not just how much energy people use, but when they use it. That we'll be able to help them save money and help us really avoid the more expensive investments, which are on more capacity.
Right.
Because we have to build, you know, to use the water analogy, the pipeline big enough for when everybody has their lights on, air conditioners on, even though that's only filled for a few hours a year. But we have to provide a pipe big enough. But if we can reduce that peak demand, then we can put in smaller pipes. And that also allows us to avoid having to put as much energy into the system as well. So
back to solar. It seems like the technologies there are improving. Perhaps the unit costs are coming down and being more competitive. Are you seeing that? And again, are you seeing that as an opportunity to expand your efforts or reach in using solar power?
There have been some dramatic improvements in the cost of solar from when we first started looking at this closely. And that's probably been 5 to 7 years ago where we really started following it. In that point in time, 20 cents per kilowatt hour or more would not have been unheard of. That cost is almost halved in the last period of time. So solar costs on what we would call a per unit basis mm-hmm. have come down dramatically. And one of the things that's interesting, our company is part of a holding company called Mid-American Energy Holdings Company. We created an LLC called Mid-American Energy Holdings Company Renewables, mm-hmm. and we're now building the three largest photovoltaic solar projects in America in Arizona and California. So for us as a utility, we can't just unilaterally do what we want, as we go back to all of my points about this joint planning and things we do. However, we want to propose to stakeholders and our regulators that they allow us to do some of this because the prices are getting down to the range where we think people are going to be more accepting of them. And so when I say that, our portfolio on average, it costs us about 5 cents per kilowatt hour for energy.
Okay.
Solar now is still 8, 9, or 10. So
right.
compared to some other, some people will claim they can do it lower or not, but our experience following others and doing some, you know, quasi requests for proposals and meeting with them indicate it's still pretty much more expensive than, say, wind with production tax credits or
natural gas.
So,
or coal.
Existing coal. De facto, it's illegal to build a coal plant in the U.S. because there's no coal technologies today that can actually meet the requirements for a new coal plant and its environmental emissions. So even though if you took those all away, coal would still be number one. But
right.
that isn't the reality. It's not going to happen. So we think still short-term wind is going to be better for us because we have great wind resources. But solar's coming, and Utah is a very good solar state.
Absolutely. That's why I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
But those states with renewable portfolio standards are going to kind of make you think a lot harder about solar and wind versus, say, Utah, which has kind of a softer, fuzzier
right.
RPS standard, right?
Yeah. And in fact, those utilities in some of those other states are being mandated to replace basically some of their existing generation with solar generation because they're not growing either, such as Oregon deciding that it's going to shut down the Boardman coal-fired power plant, mm-hmm. the only power coal plant in Oregon, early. Well, that's going to be replaced primarily with gas and wind. Because Oregon's not the best solar place. But if you go to Arizona, New Mexico, California, California's getting a remarkable amount of peak energy capacity installed. But that's really a policy decision that the state of California's made that said utilities, we want you to go do this. Because the thing I always remind people, as a regulated utility, we don't unilaterally make those decisions. We're actually we put input to policy, but we don't actually decide policy. So we're trying to start to inform. And, in fact, I would like us to build a solar project in Utah, if nothing else to call it. Let's learn a little bit about it.
Sure.
As a utility, not necessarily a third party or some pilot program. Let us just go build one and learn from it and see, well, what is the price point if we do it? Because we have, by design, lower financing costs than most other entities.
Right. In the area of nuclear power, Rocky mm-hmm. Mountain Power and Pacifico has no nuclear power in their portfolio?
We have no nuclear power in our portfolio, meaning we don't have any ownership in any nuclear power plant.
Okay.
We may buy output from the Palo Verde or
sure.
some of those other plants from the market, but we don't own, nor do we have any plans today to build a nuclear plant.
Okay. In the near future, we would say.
The near future, 15, 20 years.
Okay.
I mean, here's the several issues, of course. We can talk all day about how nuclear has its environmental impacts and
right.
the some of the risks associated. But right now, the capital costs for a gas plant versus the capital costs for a nuclear plant are so out of proportion that gas prices are going to have to really change, I think. But the reason I think nuclear is probably going to evolve into some role is there's still only a couple resources that we as utility people count on 24 hours mm-hmm. a day. And that's really, I'll call it thermal generation and whatever the heat source is, whether it's a geothermal heat source, gas, coal, nuclear, until or unless there's this breakthrough in battery storage where you build a lot more renewable than you need because
sure.
you're going to harvest the energy when you don't need it and store it for when you do. Setting aside the other nuclear environmental impacts, there are no emissions of criteria pollutants or CO2.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's why there's been a little
there's
bit
no
of a
coal ash either.
There's no coal ash. They still use
no
quite a bit of water, though. But
and that's why we don't see a lot of nuclear power
right.
plants out, because of the water. They're very
yeah.
water intensive, correct?
Well, they're water intensive almost because we make them that way. So of all of our coal plants, they're all but one of them water-cooled, but all but three of our units or one plant are closed loop.
Mm.
So we don't take water out of the environment and put it back in after we've heated up, except in one case, which you probably couldn't get permitted today. The rest of them, we just run it in a closed loop cycle, and then we just have to add a little bit of water to make up for, you know, some leakage or evaporation. So in the state of Utah, the amount of water that's used for thermal generation is a very low percentage. And if you go talk to the state water engineer, it's a few percent compared to large amounts. But it is absolutely an issue in a growing population where water usage is going higher. There's not a lot of low-cost resource additions to be made there either. And it's clearly one of the things we think about when we think about, well, would we build a nuclear plant? If we did, when would it be? What kind of technology? Probably not the existing technology, but the smaller modular reactors.
Right.
I mean, there's lots of factors. We don't need any new resources, and so it doesn't make much sense for us to spend a whole lot of time thinking about a nuclear plant in Utah, which may not be the best place anyway for our company.
Richard Walgies, president and CEO of Rocky Mountain Power at PacifiCorp. Thanks again for stopping by the studios here at KPCW and joining me on This Green Earth.
No, thank you, Chris. I greatly enjoyed it.
And that was a taped interview I had a couple weeks ago with Richard Walgies, CEO of Rocky Mountain Power. We're going to take a break for a couple of underwriters, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Paul Sabin, author of The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and our gamble over Earth's future. It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters.
I'm Scott Chester with the Park City High School Booster Club. Keep in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report. We'll bring it to you every Monday during morning news with Leslie Thatcher and in the afternoon on the Local View with Randy Barton. Highlights, scores, schedules, all things minors every Monday. The Minor Nation Report is brought to you by the UPS stores with two locations serving you, one on Park Avenue, the other in Kimball Junction, and Elliott Work Group, creating community one building at a time.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Anne from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, and I'm joined today by my co-host Larry Warren. One day in October 1990, the iconoclastic economist Julian Simon received a check in his mailbox for $576.07. The check was payment for a bet he had wagered with biologist Paul Ehrlich, the biologist and author of the controversial book, The Population Bomb. What was the bet about, and why did such an insignificant amount of money between two people who couldn't stand each other have such an impact upon the concepts of population control, natural resource consumption, and free market ingenuity? Are we headed for a world of scarce resources and environmental catastrophe, or will market forces and technological innovation yield greater prosperity for all people, no matter how many? Joining us to discuss all this is Paul Sabin, Associate Professor of American History at Yale and author of the new book, The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over Earth's Future. Paul, thanks for joining Larry and myself on This Green Earth.
Great. Chris, Larry, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, let's start here. We've done a little bit in the intro talking about Paul Ehrlich and Julian Simon. Why don't you give us a little more sketch about who each one of these individuals were and basically what their story was with respect to population growth and natural resource capacities.
Sure. Well, Paul Ehrlich came to fame in 1968 with the publication of a blockbuster book called The Population Bomb, which warned that human overpopulation was going to lead to a whole series of disasters, including possibly famine, disease, warfare. But he's very focused on the idea that the human overpopulations would sort of follow a model similar to what he'd studied with butterflies, and other scientists had studied that there would be a great population growth that would then lead to a kind of overshoot and a population collapse. And so he thought that this was going to happen as well with human populations. And he became even more famous, I guess, when he went on the Johnny Carson show in 1970, proved to be a very entertaining guest despite his very grim predictions about the future. He's a good sense of humor and a great guest, and became a well-known household name and part of the rise of the environmental movement at that time.
So Ehrlich basically saw the world as kind of a petri dish that had finite capacities, holding capacities, finite resources, and a finite ability to serve a growing population.
That's right. No, he had the idea of the laws of nature that if you there's a finite amount of resources, and that if the population grew too much, ultimately there would have to be a population collapse by one way or another. And he was issuing a warning to humanity to take action to reduce the population through kind of social and political means rather than risking one of these disasters that he was anticipating.
Okay, so meanwhile, Julian Simon is sitting at home watching TV and with growing umbrage watching Ehrlich.
He's not seeing the humor in the Tonight Show when Ehrlich's on.
No, not at all.
Exactly. So he's an economist. What's his point of view?
So Simon actually, interestingly, early on believed that population growth was a problem, but then came to believe by around 1970 that, in fact, population growth was not a hindrance to economic growth, and that human population growth really wasn't a problem. And instead, we should really just celebrate a greater number of people on the earth. That was part of the purpose of society, was to increase life expectancy and the numbers of people enjoying life. And he believed that we weren't running out of resources.
Well, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I was just going to say, and consider the times. It was 1980, and the president was Jimmy Carter, and he was all doom and gloom, and the oil embargo was on, and inflation was raging, and along comes Ronald Reagan saying, you know, I believe in the American spirit.
Just the opposite.
And just the polar opposite. And it's kind of the Ehrlich was the surrogate for Carter in that example, and Simon for Reagan.
Yeah, I think that it's really interesting that they made this bet in starting in 1980, because it really did capture these two ways of thinking about the world as represented by Carter, who really believed in limits, that we had to learn to live with less, that we had to turn the thermostat down, wear sweaters and long underwear, and that we were going to run out of oil. And Reagan, when he declared for president, actually denounced these experts who said that Americans had to live with scarcity, and instead he called for the unleashing of the market to bring greater abundance. And so they really did sort of stake out similar terrain to Ehrlich and Simon, and I think that's part of what I try to do in the book is really to show how Ehrlich and Simon's ideas kind of map onto a long-running debate between liberals and conservatives in the United States.
Right, right. So they have a simple wager.
Right. Yeah.
Simon loved to bet, and
he did love to bet.
So he always felt that was the proof of any concept of theory. All right, you believe in this, let's bet. So what was the bet about?
So they made a bet on the prices of five metals, and it was a bundle of $1,000 worth of these metals. They were chromium, copper, nickel, tin, and tungsten. And these were metals that were actually chosen by Ehrlich, and he was joined in the bet with two of his friends, fellow scientists, John Hart and John Holdren, who were then teaching at the University of California, Berkeley. And they chose these metals thinking that they were strategic, and that if population growth continued, that they would become increasingly scarce and their prices would rise. And so the bet itself was really a proxy for these two visions of the future. Ehrlich's idea that population growth would lead to scarcity and therefore, in his mind, the increased prices of the metals. Simon's idea that innovation, the forces of the marketplace, would lead to a decline or a holding level of prices. So he had a more optimistic view about what would happen in the future over the course of the 1980s. So it was a 10-year bet, and basically the winner of the bet, the loser of the bet, would pay the difference in price of the bundle. So if the bundle of metals fell by 50%, then you would pay $500. If it increased by 50%, then you would pay $500.
Right. Right, and over the course of that decade, ending in 1990, the price of that basket of metals actually did fall.
It did. It fell by around 50%, and sent this check, and ever since, there's been a debate about what this bet means and what is signified by a bet over a bundle of metals.
Well, exactly, because if you carried that bet forward for future decades, Ehrlich would have won more than Simon would have.
Right. It's complicated. I mean, if you went back to 1900 and kind of ran the bet every 10 years, so 1900, 1910, 1901 to 1911, up to 2008 or so, Ehrlich would have won around 63% of the time or so. But if you took the year 1980, however, Ehrlich only would have, won the bet starting in 2007 or so, and then kind of the most recent run-up. Even then, I'm not totally sure because the prices were very high in 1980, and so they really had a long way to go down.
So there was a lot of timing involved in this, and I'm always kind of curious. This is a better question for Ehrlich himself, I guess. Why five metals, and why not just a basket of goods? Whether it's a barrel of oil or an acre of land or a bushel
of corn,
or rice, a gallon of water, some things that had actual real-world daily impact.
Use by everyone.
Right. I mean, I think they thought these were strategic. There really had been a boom in the prices of metals over the course of the 1970s. The Hunt brothers famously gambled billions of dollars on the price of silver, and then they actually ended up losing a tremendous amount of their fortune when the price collapsed. So I think there was a lot of attention to In addition to the price of oil, the price of key metals as being another key indicator.
Right. So Simon effectively won and was elated, jubilant. Ehrlich kind of thought that, well, I might have lost this battle, but I still felt that, you know, the war was going to end in my terms, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Ehrlich thought, he might have lost a bet about some metals, but that didn't really mean much beyond the price of these metals. He was more interested in the larger question of the fate of humanity, the growing population, and what that might mean.
Yeah, and you talked to Ehrlich. Simon was unavailable for an interview, being deceased.
Passed away.
Yes,
but you did talk to Paul Ehrlich about the bet, and what was his take on losing and what it
right, 20 years later.
Ultimately said about anything?
Well, I think he felt that. That this bet didn't really represent very much. It was just some metal prices, and that they go up and they go down, so I think he thought it really doesn't say much about the larger questions of environment and resources and the well-being of human populations. And so he really sort of rejects the significance of it and sort of says that he got kind of made. I think he regrets taking the bet.
He made a bad
symbolic.
Bet.
Yeah, well, exactly. He regrets the the way that it's been taken, its symbolic value. I think really obviously doesn't like that, but thinks that he's right about the larger questions that were at stake about in the bet.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Paul Sabin. He's associate professor of American history at Yale and the author of the new book, The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over Earth's Future. So, Paul, getting back to the concepts of population, I mean, Ehrlich, I guess even today, both Ehrlich and Simon can look out over the landscape and see examples of where their prophesizing has come true, in a sense that Simon can actually point towards areas of, say, energy systems where the technological advances in solar and wind have actually benefited economies and societies, and their prices, their unit prices are coming down.
It carries back to your interview with the president of Rocky Mountain Power.
Yeah, exactly. And same thing with natural gas. The prices of natural gas are coming down because of advances in technology. But at the same time, Ehrlich could say, well, you have just the opposite going. The price of a barrel of oil has continued to go up and will continue to go up. Nuclear power has never been the panacea that we all thought it was. So, it's these two extremists refused to recognize that perhaps there was some value in each other's positions.
I think that's right. There was real unwillingness to listen to the other side, and I see that as in some ways a metaphor for the larger paralysis that's in our country. That, mm-hmm. that we have people sort of staking out very divergent positions on environmental questions and on the debate over climate, for instance, and not really listening very well to the other side and trying to understand their perspective. I mean, on the question of energy, I think that so far it seems that Simon's position is prevailing in the sense that we are currently living in another age of energy of significant energy production, then the kind of the horizon of energy scarcity has receded again. So I guess to the extent, I guess the point is that the predictions that we were going to run out of various forms of energy by now, obviously those haven't taken place. Whether that will take place in the future, mm-hmm. That's still an unanswered question. And really, the title of my book, The Bet, it's about this little bet, but it's also about the bet we're making about the future.
Right.
And there are a lot of unanswered questions about that.
Well, and when you look at the energy example specifically, I guess it proves Simon and free markets are right. If the price went up enough that companies went out investing in exploration and new technologies, and as a result, they found more.
I think that's right, and I think it's an important lesson for all of us to remember. I guess is these powerful dynamics of the marketplace, that there isn't, I guess, a linear relationship between abundance and scarcity. You know, that we go from a situation of abundance, sort of marching our way to scarcity, but rather that there's more cycles of booms and busts and responsiveness to prices. And that's a lot. If you go back to the bet that Ehrlich and Simon made, you would see that in a variety of the different in the different metals. You'd see the high prices of the 70s leading to increased opening up of new mines, the substitution of new technologies, you know, fiber optic cables and satellites and aluminum and plastic, you know, substituting for copper. So that by the middle of the decade, there was really an effort to try to generate a market for copper. At that time, and a lot of the mines were getting shut. So there's really not that's an important lesson. There's not a linear relationship. It's mm-hmm. a much more complex situation.
Right. But with respect to, again, population, you know, is there a holding capacity to not just the planet? But I look at population issues on kind of a geographical or socio-political scale. There are some areas, even within this country, that have a holding capacity that are far different. The holding capacity for Salt Lake City and a high desert area like this is far different than the holding capacity, say, of the Hudson River Valley or the holding capacity of South Florida. You know, there's only so many people and so many resources that can provide for those areas. Simon seemed to believe that there was a limitless holding. He felt that this globe could handle 10, 20, 30 billion people, whereas Ehrlich, I think his holding capacity was far less than that, somewhere around 2.5 or 3 billion.
Yeah, even as low
as 1.5.
Well,
we've blown past that.
Yeah, and we've gone by that.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think we have to be really cautious about how we use the idea of holding or carrying capacity as it relates to human populations and also particular regions. I mean, we have integrated economies and trading networks, so for the most part, most places in the world are not operating independently of on the resources that are only available within their geographic region. And I think it's more so I guess I think we're pretty far still from the ultimate carrying capacity that could potentially exist for humans on the planet. And it's more a question of what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of environment do we want to create? I mean, through industrial processes and science, we may very, perhaps we could support many more people. The question is, ultimately, is that a world that we want to be headed for? So I think it's really, the idea that we're going to hit a sharp limit where all of a sudden, there's just not enough food to feed everybody. We're still pretty far from that, and I think that's not actually the right question to be asking ourselves. Are we just gonna run out of food? I think it'd be better to think about, well, what kind of world do we want to live in ultimately, and think more about values and ethics and politics as a better strategy.
Right. That's true. Although if you were to go to a favela in Rio or Sao Paulo or the slums of Cairo or Manila, you might see a completely different quality of life and ask yourself, is this just too many people in too confined an area? And not enough resources to supply them. Is that something that Ehrlich would kind of provide examples of?
Well, I mean that certainly is was his take on this, and he was very profoundly moved by an experience he had going to India in the mid 1960s and seeing the poverty and the crowded streets and the sort of the chaotic chaos of humanity that existed there. But I think that again, these different areas are not living independently of each other, and so you can have a very crowded crowded area that's economically vibrant, that's producing a lot, that's generating a lot of it's contributing to the broader economy and isn't necessarily self-sustaining. So I guess carrying capacity is a funny word to apply. to specific places. I mean, you can have shortages of water, I guess, or you can be drawing too much water from other places, and so then you're kind of coming up against the limits maybe of what one area can easily do. But it's not, you know, that's really, again, it's sort of a political question. How much water can you know, Las Vegas pull from other places in order to be able to, or L.A., you know, to sustain itself?
Sure. That is our ongoing challenge out here out west. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, there are parts of the world that are suffering from population loss, you know, in the Eastern Europe or certain parts of the ex-Soviet Union where there's actually not enough people.
Right, you know,
And so their economies are suffering as a result. So
I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, someone like Simon, his perspective on these densely populated places was that, you know, one of the challenges they faced were often had to do really with the structure of property rights and legal rights and the inability of people in favelas or elsewhere to, you know, to own their own home, to protect, you know, to be able to accumulate resources and better their conditions. And that part of what you see in you know, situations of poverty in some of these places is, you know, it really has to do with the dysfunction of the political and economic system. It's not necessarily that it's just a shortage of resources, but that it's dysfunctional in other ways.
Right. Yeah, Paul, getting back to the bet itself and what it represented, you had a piece in the New York Times just Sunday, and I guess what the bet represented is extremism on one side, environmental Paul Ehrlich doom and gloom, and Simon on the other with eternal optimism, and that has sort of been the ensuing for the next 40 years battle between environmentalists and conservatives, liberals and conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, however you want to divide it.
Right.
And it just seems like as a society, as two points of view, we're not much closer than Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich were 40 years ago.
Right.
I mean, it's still tough to get a rancher and a Sierra Club activist to see an issue the same way, or a you know, a coal advocate and a wind power person to see the middle.
I think that's right. I think the idea of the idea of the bet that that there's a winner and a loser here, and that one side's going to be totally right and the other side's going to be totally wrong, is does stand for some of the problems that we have in our politics right now, which is that it sets us up not really to be able to listen to each other and to see the insights that the other side might have. And I also think that there are historical consequences of these debates that unfolded over population growth and resource scarcity, in the sense that our current arguments about climate change are kind of stuck in those ruts from those previous debates, and both sides are kind of distrustful of each other, even though the climate question is actually different from population growth. It's not the same. It's a different kind of issue.
That's what I was saying. We got a couple minutes, and then, like I say, the things have become so polarized, and the climate change issue is just another. You know what? It's just another bet that we're making.
We are making another bet. And so I guess the question is an actual public policy. Is there a way that we can not just choose? We're either going to side, are going to say you're entirely right or you're entirely right and just choose one direction, or whether we can actually learn from, you know, some of the insights that Simon had about human adaptability, about markets, about
geoengineering, let's say.
Possibly about geoengineering, about adaptability, and Ehrlich's insights about how the planet's changing, the possible dangers that we might face, I think that if we listen to each other better, we might be able to find a more pragmatic path. And actually, going back to what you're saying about, you know, the Sierra Club and ranchers, I actually think at the local level and even at the state level, you can find some very interesting examples of collaborations that really that break out of this divide. mean, there's still been divisiveness around things like the reintroduction of wolves, but there also were some important bargains struck about, you know, around that that have led to interesting innovations in practical land policy. So I think actually if you go to the local and the state level, you can find some interesting innovations that don't necessarily conform to these national and more abstract debates about the future.
So I guess we're running out of time, but just so you studied this, you wrote a book about it. What's the takeaway from your book?
The ultimate lesson
that can be learned from the Ehrlich-Simon bet.
Well, I mean, I think we need to learn from both sides of this liberal and conservative divide, both understanding the power of markets and human adaptability and innovation, but also the real threats that we face in the form of things like climate change, and that we have to find a way to strike a balance between these insights rather than just choosing between one or the other. Right. And that ultimately, I think, it's a question more of social values about the kind of world that we want to live in rather than the absolutes that someone like Ehrlich or Simon talked about, that either we would go entirely into a kind of an apocalyptic scenario or just this beautiful, optimistic future that Simon envisioned, that rather, instead we have to work more in the pragmatic middle of in which we're balancing and bringing these different ideas together and using our politics and our values to find answers.
Paul Sabin, he's the Associate Professor of American History at Yale and the author of the new book, The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over Earth's Future. Paul, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with Larry and me on This Green Earth this morning.
Thanks. It's great, great conversation. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Hey, let's take one last break for some underwriters, and we'll come back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Head into summer with us as we explore health, nutrition, and lifestyle with the experts.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Join us for The Mountain Life.
Designer babies, driverless cars, tracking devices on everything and everyone. This is the future, and it's coming fast. So you think that within 5 years, people will be sitting in the passenger seat while their car drives them to work? I'm Guy Raz, predicting the future on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10, brought to you by Board Dogs.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, for 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues and the concept of sustainability. It's time to start wrapping up. Larry, again, thanks for joining me as
my
co-host
pleasure.
Today.
My pleasure. Big fan of the show, so now I are
you
part
are part of
it.
And if you want to hear yourself, you can listen to the taped replay. That'll be available on the website, kpcw.org, later this afternoon. Again, thanks to Paul Sabin about his book, The Bet, and Richard Walgi, CEO of Rocky Mountain Power. Great conversation with him about Rocky Mountain Power's plans and futures. And
it really was.
Yeah.
And some encouraging things heard in that.
Yes. And of course, we always want to thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible without. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Republic Services, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate. You can always join us and learn more about This Green Earth on our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Again, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week for another show. We're going to be having Brian McInerney on for the National Weather Service.
All things water. Maybe some winter snow predictions.
He's tough to get a prediction out of. He likes to talk about the past. That's a little more, that has a little more quantifiable effort and meshes to it. But join us next week for that. And remember, only in Park City, only on KPCW. This is 91.9 Park City, Utah.